Professor Derek Bolton from King's College London and Institute of Psychiatry, who's going to talk on localising metaphysics, continuity to science and culture.
Thank you, Rachel. If the philosophy of psychiatry is particularly marked by metaphysical disagreements, I think that's likely because its explicit key interrelated topics are so close to those in philosophy, past and present, mind, consciousness, cognition, order, disorder, rationality, science, knowledge and methodology. That's what philosophy and psychiatry gets involved with. It's what psychiatry is involved with. And it's hard to imagine how one could have a view on these matters that did not have to do with positions familiar in philosophy. However, have to do with does not necessarily mean that it needs, in the sense of is derived from or based on. The question arises how claims as to the nature of these things, of which I've just listed them, are based. Now, familiar view is that claims can be either empirically based, a matter for empirical science, or they are conceptual truths, philosophical truths, especially if they concern these traditional philosophical concepts which I've just listed. A split of this sort is of course familiar in the history of philosophy, especially clear in the way that we characterize, for example, empiricism and rationalism in modern thought. Arguably, these two approaches envisage a hard and fast demarcation between truths of experience and truths of reason, philosophical truths, even if they interpret what these are in different ways. However, this demarcation between truths of experience known to science and truths of reason known to philosophy or metaphysics has been eroded in many, many ways by various writers through approximately the 20th century. I will give three diverse illustrations of this. Wittgenstein, in his early period, had philosophical propositions as nonsense, notwithstanding the fact that he wrote a highly systematized, otherwise coherent philosophical system. In his later work, Wittgenstein had again not much time for philosophical propositions, though apparently from time to time that they figure large, or apparently figure large, if somewhat blurred, for example, in the apparent arguments against the idea that the meaning of a word is an object and should be understood rather in terms of what is found in human activity according to a rule, right or wrong actions, at around which point in the argument in the investigations, human agreement also seems to figure large. Suggestive and important though all this in Wittgenstein might be, it stops far short of a systematized metaphysics from which we may derive propositions in the philosophy of science or indeed anywhere else. Purcell, to take another example, also in the modernist period like the Tractatus, supposed that there were a priori transcendental truths about experience that could be known by a certain philosophical methodology. Such truths including that human beings were embodied as knowing agents and involved in intersubjectivity. Eventually, the characteristic modernist tension between these two positions ended in Husserl with the acknowledgement that the one excludes the other, that a priori transcendental metaphysics for an epistemic subject that is embodied and socially embedded is hardly possible. If you localize the subject, you're not going to get transcendental truths, and I think Husserl saw that by the end. Coming a bit more up to date, Quine, in his seminal 1960 paper, Two Dogmas of Empiricism, argued clearly that the system of propositions meets experience as an integrated whole, that there is a continuity between propositions tied close to experience on the one hand and other highly theoretical propositions, including scientific theory, but also crucially for the present purpose in philosophy itself. In short, there was no hard and fast synthetic analytic distinction, and therefore also no demarcated fundamental or overarching metaphysics different from science and cultural beliefs generally. This recent history suggests that there is unlikely to be a metaphysical domain of knowledge independently of other forms of knowledge and belief in science and general assumptions in the culture at any one time. Or again, that there is no foundational, or to switch the metaphor, superior level metaphysics from which to derive something more mundane, such as propositions in the philosophy of psychiatry. But this conclusion has a broader application affecting pure philosophy, not just applied. So, assuming that, for the sake of argument at least, that this line of thought is correct, what is left for philosophy and for the philosophy of science specifically? These considerations suggest that what counts as philosophy is likely to be, or at least likely to include, explication of the fundamental assumptions in the system of belief and practice, although for a particular culture at a particular time. This is what I mean by localizing metaphysics. These fundamental assumptions will certainly include those at work in the sciences, but also in the culture more broadly understood. Moreover, pursuing the line of thought, the distinction between the assumptions at work in the sciences on the one hand and those in the culture generally on the other will likely not be hard and fast, but more likely shared, with complex relations between them, one shaping the other, cultural beliefs of shaping the science and vice versa, in different ways at different times. I'd like to illustrate this point briefly in relation to the two books that I'm responsible for, Mind, Meaning and Mental Disorder, co-authored with Jonathan Hill, and a subsequent single-authored book, What is Mental Disorder, because for this purpose they draw on different kinds of background. In Mind, Meaning and Mental Disorder, I was more concerned, speaking now for myself and not for my co-author, with tracking what the current biological and psychological sciences were up to. I was trying to track what the sciences were doing. I was not thinking here of science as tracking some absolute truth, which, with my Wittgensteinian background and the other considerations I mentioned earlier, I'm not particularly concerned with. Thinking of the sciences, and particularly their general assumptions and framework, as being a major influence on the thinking and practice in and around psychiatry. In What is Mental Disorder, by contrast, I spent relatively little time with the sciences, in the belief that the sciences had little role to play in demarcating health from disease, which I was rather inclined to believe and argue was shaped by the culture at large. In more detail about Mind, Meaning and Mental Disorder, I was working with the assumption of the current biological and psychological sciences, which were dominated and still are by the information processing paradigm, arguing that in this way the sciences had broken down the old dichotomies of mechanized matter and immaterial, scientifically irrelevant mind, and that this fundamental theoretical development should be explicated in order to bring the theory of psychiatry more up to date. In pursuing this line of thought of what was going on in the sciences, I was more concerned with what was going on in the sciences more than what was going on in Wittgenstein's philosophy or anyone else's. Nevertheless, as Quine suggested or saw in his Two Dogmas paper, there is likely to be a continuity or congruence between, at any one time, high-level theory in the sciences, perhaps in Kuhn's expression, the current paradigms, and what we think of as philosophy. However, not all philosophy is likely to be the same in this respect. For example, mind-brain identity theory and functionalism are, of course, one way to go beyond dualism, but my view was that they still retain too much commitment to previous theory. And by contrast, the information processing paradigm as it was being developed in the biopsychological sciences correctly grasps the post-dualist view of content on cognition as essentially involved in the regulation of action. And in pursuing this idea, Wittgenstein's later work on meaning and rules seemed to me among the closest philosophy around that could explicate this point. Dennett's work on the intentional stance is another example, and I spent a lot of time as well on that in the book. But that wasn't to say that I was trying to stay here with Wittgenstein. It was just a close philosophical explication of an idea which seemed to me to be needed to be explicated in the sciences. So here's an example of where I went in the book with Jonathan Hill that's not Wittgensteinian at all. For example, one of the key arguments in the book is that the notion of normativity, representation and error, content and error, already begin in biology and do not start for the first time in psychology. Now, this conclusion does not derive from Wittgenstein in any way. I do think that a highly abstract level, the kind of view that we can take Wittgenstein to be proposing is compatible with this, but I have no inclination at all to suppose that this has anything to do with what Wittgenstein actually wrote or indeed meant. As I say, my primary interest was to pursue the assumptions of the sciences, not the assumptions of philosophers as such. Now, mind, meaning, and mental disorder was about causal explanations in psychiatry and did not interrogate the concept of mental disorder, which I took up in the subsequent book, What is Mental Disorder? Now, my starting point from that was clearly a cultural one. From the 1960s onwards, mental illness had come to be seen as hardly a scientific concept at all, but more as a social one. One, moreover, that was essentially disqualifying, socially excluding, and yes. Since the 1960s, and this is the point about the way that culture moves, since the 1960s, the culture had moved to include people with that label. The concept had become unstable, and a new concept was emerging, something along the lines of people in trouble, but not automatically disqualified as epistemic agents. I did see this as primarily a shift in the culture, a further application of the Enlightenment project, and not primarily a shift in the science. So to pursue this point, the sciences investigate conditions of interest, illnesses in this case, but what counts as such, how to prioritise among them, is settled less by the scientists and more by key players in the profession and the broader culture. But there are many kinds of illustration of this. Consider, for example, the scientific work done recently and clinical applications around the discovery that many people in the general population, not only clinically referred samples, hear voices, that's to say when there's nothing there. I would guess that this has always been known, but not of any special interest, since the primary interest was a madness as a feared abstract noun. As this becomes less important in the culture, we can attend to the people with the symptoms, even drop the word symptoms in favour of difference and diversity. Now, one might ask, and here I'm going to try and allude to the history of ideas, why was madness so feared and so construed to essentially involve delusion and hallucination? It appears in this way at the foundation of modern philosophy, in Descartes' derivation of the problem of knowledge of the external world, hallucination and delusion being the fundamental cognitive failure. Consistent with the epistemology crystallizing at the time, but involving also a social level disqualification of the mad as an offence to rationality, as theorised by Foucault. It looks like the scaffold is have come after all, but I'll press on. My view is that at this level of defining what knowledge is and its fundamental failures and epistemic agencies, philosophy and culture tend to merge. One can see the same thing in Locke, for example. His empiricism secured theoretical epistemic equality. But this was also consistent with his political theory that legitimate government requires consent. For that to work, you need the citizens to have epistemic equality, competence. My own view is that the Enlightenment project of ever-inclusive epistemic and political equality has continued and is continuing from its original narrow practical base of land-owning white males to working men with economic power, to women, to people with different ethnic backgrounds, to people with varying sexual orientations, and in the same spirit, inevitably it will happen, people who have been previously labelled as and disqualified as having a mental illness. This last issue, however, is particularly interesting in a particular way, insofar as mental illness in some circumstances apparently does interfere with epistemic competence and credibility. Now, there's much to be said about all this. There's much to be said about that narrow problem. But to get to the narrow problem, we do indeed have to narrow it down, to break up, to deconstruct the idea that mental disorder is one thing, alien and essentially disqualifying. And it seems to me that that's been the work of the culture, that the culture has been busy with this deconstruction for some time, all through the 20th century, with the help of theoreticians like Freud, and popular culture that deals with nervous breakdown, anorexia, and indeed schizophrenia on Coronation Street. This is the way the culture operates, to shift representations. Now, to sum up, I see metaphysics as continuous with culture generally and scientific paradigms specifically. This is compatible with what I take to be the characteristic 20th century view that an a priori transcendental metaphysics has become impossible. And I see that in turn as part and parcel of the now fact for us that the epistemic agent is embodied and culturally embedded. Nevertheless, this 20th century post or late modern fact has a weaker sense of a priori, and with it a weaker sense of metaphysics as being the highest theoretical level, or switching the metaphor for some purposes, foundational level of current belief systems and practice systems, which are the least likely to be negotiable in relation to experience and the most likely to guide our interpretation of experience and action. The function and status of this weaker sense of a priori has been especially well explicated by Lakatosh for scientific theory and by Wittgenstein in On Certainty for Daily Life. A simple implication of this approach, this view, is that what is a priori, fundamental and axiomatic, taken for granted as the obvious starting place, not requiring inquiry, in one cultural time and place is not necessarily the same as it is in a different time and place. For us now, by us I mean approximately Western Europe around now and in a globalized world, of course it's complicated. Well, what is axiomatic for us now is something like human beings practice an intersubjectivity, the social. And I say in reference to what we're going to hear later on, this same line of thought makes the environment important as well, because action needs the environment to work for us, not just the social environment. Now, this is quite a different place than, say, Descartes or Locke, who started, at least when doing epistemology, with subjective ideas of one sort or another. The point is not, however, that one cultural axiom would necessarily be denied by another. The philosophers of the 17th and 18th century, of course, wrote much about human activities, and we now can happily refer to ideas, perceptions, and subjectivity. It is more a matter of what is axiomatic, and hence the nature of the general frame. So the fact that we are human beings involved together would not be denied, let's suppose, by any other cultural epistemology. But still, it is not always the first most important fact, which might be, for example, subjective experience, as it was for Descartes, or mathematical reasoning, as it was for Galileo, or revealed truth by the people who believe that about the Bible, or a creation myth, and so on. In this context, one role for philosophy, or what could be called metaphysics, is to explicate the fundamental assumptions of the sciences and the culture. In that sense, it's not so much that philosophy of psychiatry requires a metaphysics. It would be better to say that it is metaphysics, but of course, needless to say, more or less well done. In the sense in which philosophy of psychiatry is metaphysics, more or less well done, I think psychiatry itself is. So one might pose a rather different question than the one we pose today. Does psychiatry as a practice need metaphysics? And I'd run through exactly the same points. And what would come out is not that psychiatrists sit down and work out a metaphysics and then do what they do. They certainly don't do that. But they are part of a scientific culture, a health provision culture, and a culture generally in which there are certain assumptions about fundamental things which they act on in a more or less way that in a way that they are more or less aware of. So when clinicians are working or researchers are deciding what they want to research or how they want to research it, where they're finding interesting research questions, perhaps dictated to them by funding panels or governments, there are metaphysical assumptions at work. They are often of the kind that Peter described earlier from quoting some other author, of the table thumping variety. Well, of course it must be in the brain would be one, or of course it must be in unconscious or in attachment, you know. So there will be these assumptions, and in this case is one job of the philosophy of psychiatry to interrogate what those assumptions and presuppositions are. So I'm getting close, but I want to stop in half an hour, but there's a page left. Got to find it. Oh, yes. I'd like to finish with some remarks on change and activism, which links with the question, if all philosophy and metaphysics does is to explicate current assumptions, is it basically simply descriptive of the status quo? Does it leave everything as it is, to quote Wittgenstein? Is it fundamentally conservative? Now, where Wittgenstein stood on this is, I think, obscure. On the one hand, Wittgenstein in the investigations starts with human activities. Do you remember in the first paragraph, one has to start somewhere? But arguably his main interest in both periods was actually language, and increasingly in his later period, particularly of the in the notes and remarks, we are inside language, and we see everything through it. Now, whether this it, language, is singular or changes, I have no idea. It's like a hermeneutic space that Wittgenstein is operating in. And I think it's quite different from his fundamental idea in the investigations that language serves our form of life and is involved in our form of life. And that idea is also in Uncertainty. But if we do see languages involved in our forms of life, they are certainly diverse and changing. It's not one thing. Now as a different example, second time I've referred to Locke, and I'm pleased Peter referred to Locke, so we got this in common. Locke, of course, famously had philosophy as the handmaiden of science. But in fairness to Locke, the science he had in mind was itself new and revolutionary. This was not like normal science. This was a big shift that had gone on. But there were other aspects of Locke which, of course, were entirely revolutionary. For example, there is nothing more revolutionary than Locke's polemical demolition of the idea that the right to rule passes through the bloodline. So philosophy, as I understand it, can be critical, not merely descriptive. And this, I think, in two main related ways. Philosophy proceeds by argumentation, and in metaphysics specifically, argumentation from axioms, starting places. Philosophy wants to drill down to assumptions, it wants proofs, consistency, so that not everything can be proved. This is, of course, a familiar view of philosophy, and it can be understood in the context of the paper that I'm giving as that by this means it will not locate a priori assumptions good for all times and places, but only what is going on at a particular cultural moment. Together with that, philosophy is understood in terms of this particular methodology is distinct from other fields of inquiry. There is no other field of inquiry which takes its job as being penetrating to assumptions and axioms and proofs. But still, that does not mean that it will penetrate down to truths which are good for all time. There is diversity in beliefs, value, and practices, and at any one time they are often in tension and competition, and partly for that reason they're changing. This is evident in the sciences and in culture generally. Culture generally is constantly changing, and changes partly because of the tensions between various groups and interests. This has, of course, been a familiar view since Hegel. And philosophy can serve to defend the status quo, in which case its role is essentially conservative. It lacks innovation and tends not to be remembered much for long as things move on. More innovative and memorable is the philosophy in its critical mode, where it explicates what is wrong with the current system, which typically no longer works as the world changes, is no longer fit for the purpose of planning action, and proposes something new. Ultimately, this will be tied together with the interests and values of particular groups. All of this applies most obviously to do with the philosophies and the sciences that deal explicitly with human nature, whether construed individualistically or socially. I've suggested previously that the philosophy of psychiatry does not need better physics, as if this were a distinctive domain of knowledge, but is rather part of the general effort in the sciences and culture to clarify basic assumptions and policies. It should be added, following these remarks about change, that it can be either conservative, critical, or radical, but whichever of these, it is distinguished by philosophy's distinctive methodology, implemented more or less well, of explicit identification of axioms, argumentation, and consistency. Thank you very much.